Thank you all. So this paper is drawn from my PhD chapter on representation of falcons in early modern drama, especially in the works of Shakespeare. And I look at how falconry as an elite sport was taken on by early modern dramatists to subvert and complicate concepts of sovereignty. So I thought it was good to have an image of King James VI of Scotland, given that we're in Glasgow, when he was the boy king of Scotland, and the idea of him practicing falconry was part of his training to become a man and a king. But that's quite separate to how gendered readings of falconry are appropriated in early modern drama. And when examining allusions to falconry in Shakespeare's plays, scholars most often refer to the taming of the shrew, due to the similarities between Petruchio's oppressive taming of his new wife Catherine and the methods of training a hawk. These studies commonly conclude that Shakespeare invokes falconry in these plays, in this play, to portray Elizabethan attitudes towards marriage. In her study on masculinity and hunting in the early modern period, Catherine Bates argues that the specific gendering of falconry made the sport an easy metaphor for love and for the figuring of male-female relations. Such gendered readings of the falconry trope are accurate in as much as early modern allusions to the sport are imbued with connotations of the sexual chase and patriarchal authority for the following reasons. So most prize raptors were female because they were larger. The majority of falconers and authors of falconry manuals tend to be male, although many aristocratic women did participate in the sport. I won't be talking about that today, but I'm happy to discuss it in questions if anyone's interested. The process of reclaiming a falcon or a hawk is alternatively known as manning, and the manuals commonly resort to the language of love and courtship to describe the taming process. However, it's been largely overlooked that when formulating the process of manning, falconry manuals also appropriate the language of governance, instructing keepers how to rule over their birds in order to bring them to subjection and serve their keepers' desires. So when researching and writing on the gendered application of the falconry trope in The Taming of the Shrew and several other early modern plays, I became interested in the emphasis in falconry manuals on developing an emotional bond between falconer and raptor, which was predicated on love, trust, and mutual respect, but specifically to secure their loyalty. However, as falconry requires raptors to be released from their restraints, thus allowing them to fly out of the reach of their human masters, there are apparent anxieties about whether this emotional bond is strong enough to make hawks or falcons return to their keepers. Furthermore, while falconry manuals advise their readers on how to tame and maintain the obedience of their raptors, they sometimes express regret at the loss of freedom and question the assumed autonomy of their birds. So through examination of a selection of early modern falconry manuals, some literary texts and visual sources, this paper will argue that when taming hawks and falcons, there is a fine line between willing obedience, which is supposedly based on love, and enforced servitude, the fragility of which a seemingly tame raptor can expose at any moment. So I'm going to begin just by briefly looking at The Taming of the Shrew. So Petruchio's soliloquy in Act 4, Scene 1 of The Taming of the Shrew makes the connections between the taming of his wife with the taming of a hawk explicit. He declares, "Thus have I politically begun my reign, and 'tis my hope to end successfully. My falcon now is sharp and passing empty. Until she stoops, she must not be full-gorged, for then she never looks upon her lure. Another way I have to man my haggard to make her come and know her keeper's call, that is, to watch her as we watch these kites, that bait and beat and will not be obedient. She eat no meat today, nor none shall she eat. Last night she slept not, nor tonight she shall not." In this speech, Petruchio suggests that not allowing Catherine food and sleep is done in reverent care of her. Margaret Loftus Ranald argues that Catherine's taming is misread as oppressive, and instead cites the falconry manual's emphasis on love and mutual affection between keeper and raptor to suggest that Shakespeare uses the falconry trope to portray an atypical Elizabethan attitude toward marriage through the development of a matrimonial relationship in which mutuality, trust, and love are guiding forces. However, as the anthropologist Sara Ashu Shrier in her PhD thesis argues, which is on the study of human-avian relationships in falconry, the method of breaking raptors by exhausting them physically and mentally until their wild spirits have been overcome is now considered as fundamentally bad falconry. Shura admits that while these methods demonstrate that it's possible, in principle, to dominate a hawk and train it by coercive means, falconers feel that they put the bird's risk, health at risk, and also prevent the opportunity to build companionship with the bird and to encounter it through understanding its way of becoming, rather than through simply subduing it to human will. Indeed, Shura suggests that coercive training methods make losing the bird when out hunting more likely, as they do not develop trust and confidence in the human and fail to acknowledge that they're human as a hunting companion. So while Loftus-Reynolds suggests that the primary aim of Catherine's taming is to create a marriage of equality and respect, such a reading ignores the fact that Petrucco's methods of manning his new wife prevent a bond of mutual companionship from being formed and make the threat of her rebelling against him more likely. And Sean Benson more widely looks at the falconry trope in relation to marriage in early modern plays, and he argues that this use of falconry trope suggests that the arrogation of power in marriage is at best an uneasy accommodation, at worst destructive of married life, if not of life itself. While Petrucco states that all is done in reverent care of Catherine, his violent tendencies and the cruelty of the taming technique suggest otherwise, which is exemplified by his paradoxical claim towards the end of this taming speech that this is a way to kill a wife in kindness. Catherine is subjected to this process of taming to make her submit to her husband's will. As Edward Berry asserts in his study on Shakespeare and hunting, falconry in a similar fashion aspires towards a union of two wills, animal and human, each devoted to the same exhilarating and instinctive end, the pursuit of prey. Any such union must be one-sided, however, for ultimate power resides with the falconer alone. In line with this reading, Petrucco's taming of Catherine, as a falconer would a hawk, displays his mastery over another human and not a mutual bond of affection between husband and wife. Shakespeare's appropriation of this trope to critique Petrucco's oppressive treatment of his wife can therefore offer insights into the more positive emotional attachments that a falconer was encouraged in the falconry manuals to develop with their raptor in order to secure their obedience. So I'm now going to move on to looking in more detail at some of these falconry manuals. So according to these manuals, the most popular bird of prey in this period was the haggard hawk, a wild female bird captured in its adult plumage and the type of hawk that Petrucco explicitly identifies Catherine as when he declares, "Another way I have to man my haggard to make her come and know her keeper's call." In his 1575 manual, George Turberville praises haggard falcons as the most excellent birds of all others, as she better know the advantage of her flight because she have been forced to pray for herself and have not been subjected to the order of any keeper. However, Turberville admits that due to the inherent wildness of haggards, they wrangle and wander more than any other sort. He asserts that the only way to ensure the obedience of a haggard hawk is by rewarding her with meat, which means she will always love the lure and her keeper well. In his approved treatise of hawks and hawking, Edmund Burt describes the taming of raptors more generally and suggests, "It may be some young professor in this art is possessed that if his hawk be very hungry and sharp, she will sooner come unto him. He is herein much deceived. For unless she loveth him very well, hunger is the special means that draweth her from him. For hunger must be satisfied, and her little love to him will make her the better pleased with that she provided for herself and make her look out for her own provision. But if she be truly loving him, then there is no doubt that she would come the readilier. Mark then, if this be not the only main point for the astringer to have his hawk in love with him." Burt therefore emphasises the importance of building an emotional bond of love rather than breaking the spirit of the bird through starvation. Simon Latham focuses his 1614 manual on the haggard falcon, as he claims it is the bird that in these days most men do covet and desire to prepare and make fit for their pleasure. Like Turberville, Latham acknowledges the predisposition of haggards to wildness and dedicates the majority of his manual in instructing how to alter and change the same into love and gentleness, with subjection to the man, and so to rule and govern her. He discusses the difficulty of achieving this, as the haggard falcon is like, to quote him directly, "a conqueror in the country, keeping in awe and subjection the most part of all the fowl that fly." By representing the haggard hawk as a ruler in her own kingdom, Latham recognises the unstable power dynamics that are at play between human and raptor during the taming process, and also in aerial pursuits. He suggests that the way to ensure Haggard's love and disposition are agreeable to your desire is also through her stomach, and warns that unless this is mastered, nothing will hold her in subjection, and she will renounce all form of familiarity and acquaintance with you. While the language of love and courtship is evident in these falconry manuals, in expressing anxiety about the obedience of haggard hawks, the language of governance is also used, with an emphasis on how to rule, govern, and bring these creatures to subjection. The manuals were an essential component of falconry, as the taming of hawks and falcons was, as it is still today, an arduous process that requires great skill and patience, especially when it concerns haggard hawks, as these brief examples demonstrate. When first captured, the bird was confined in a quiet and dark space where it was denied sleep and food in order to make it more tractable. And the hood, which is pictured just here, is held. The hawk's actually unhooded here. Was also crucial in keeping the raptor calm and regulating emotions, and it acted as a mediator between the human and the animal. Once the hawk became familiar with their new master, the falconer would be able to feed the bird on the fist without her baiting, a term which describes the attempt of the raptor to fly away. The falconer would gradually carry the raptor for longer periods of time and introduce her to other humans, as well as to the hunting hounds that she would eventually hunt alongside. The importance of building a strong emotional bond between falcon and raptor during this part of the taming process is evident in a woodcut by the Swiss-German artist Jost Ammann, featured in a late 16th century illustrated German hunting tract, in which a falconer is depicted feeding an unhooded hawk on his fist, surrounded by other birds of prey and hunting hounds. The verse that is printed alongside this image is entitled How to Relate to Falcons, and suggests that a capable falconer is defined by the obedience and good temperament of his raptor. Falconers were evidently aware that the taming process was not the same for every bird, as they acknowledged their individuality. For example, in the revised 1618 edition of his falconry manual, Latham states, "All hawks be not alike in their disposition, but are of contrary natures, and therefore required great and diligent attendance and skill to find out their properties. It was the falconer's responsibility to learn the nature of their raptor and adapt the taming process accordingly." And as this woodcut demonstrates, there was an emphasis in the initial stages of the manning process on physical contact and close proximity between falconer and raptor in order to develop this trust and mutual affection. For example, in his Country Contentments in Two Books, which was published in 1615, Gervais Markman states that hawks are manned by watching and keeping them from sleep, by continual carrying of them upon your fist, and by a most familiar stroking and playing with them, with the wing of a dead fowl or such like, and by gazing often and looking of them in the face, with a loving and gentle countenance, and so making them acquainted with man. Burt similarly emphasises the importance of physical contact with man in a hawk. He suggests that in the initial stages, either upon my fist or upon some man else's, she should sit and wake all that day, with a marginal note stressing, allow her no ease but upon the fist. Marcy Norton analyses the difference between poultry and falcons and thinks about how hawks and falcons are given a sense of agency. And she discusses how, due to its emphasis on physical contact, falconry produced a very particular kind of merger between human and bird that was based on this blending of bodily space. The falconer has to adapt to carrying the hawk or falcon on their fist, and the raptor has to acclimatise to being carried by a human. The emphasis on forming a corporal bond between falconer and raptor is notably similar to the desired centaur-like union between rider and horse in the early modern period, which focuses on an apparent harmony between human and animal. This harmony, however, is largely mediated through the use of saddles, stirrups, spurs, curbs, bits, and bridles, which enable humans to forcefully harness the incredible strength of horses. Such instruments are useless in falconry, as the sport requires the physical contact between human and bird to be broken when the raptor is released from its restraints. A falconer can only trust that they have successfully formed a bond with their bird during the primary stages of a manning process, in that they will return once released. So once the sense of trust was achieved during the manning process, the falcon would take the bird to a secluded spot and begin to train her to return to the fist. During the stage of the taming process, a lever device made of a pair of bird's wings with meat attached, usually from the bird's favoured prey, would be used to recall the raptor. And an example of a lure being used is captured in this portrait of Sir Thomas Coningsby. The falconer would swing the lure above his head and call to the bird so that she'd become accustomed to his voice. Once the raptor was trained to fly to the lure from a great distance, live prey could be used and the bird's hunting capabilities were trialled in the final stage of this manning process, known as the test of unrestricted flight. The falconer relied upon the raptor's ability to take its prey, and after this was achieved, they would use the lure to reclaim her from this moment of unrestrained freedom before she gorged herself upon her kill and lost the motivation to return to her keeper. And an awareness of this suggests that the actual bonds of love aren't as strong as they thought it was. So while these methods are diligently observed in the manuals, the tractability of falcons and hawks remains a source of anxiety due to their ability to fly above the reach of their masters and forget their former allegiance, as can be seen in this woodcut, also by Jost Amann. It's in the same German hunting tract. So the three human hunters represented in this woodcut are depicted astride large horses over which they maintain control through the clearly visible bridles and reins. The central hunter's loyal greyhound waits dutifully by his master's side, awaiting the command to pursue and attack the hunter's chosen prey. The greyhound's stillness is contrasted with a pair of hounds that are depicted in the foreground, chasing a hare, followed closely by the third hunter, galloping after them on horseback. Meanwhile, the central hunter is shown craning his neck to watch an aerial battle taking place above between a hawk and a heron, completely out of his reach. His raised and empty fist, which is clearly encased in a falconry glove, suggests that the hunter has to wait for her to return once she has completed the kill. And due to the sport's unpredictable nature, which is why King James VI, who later became King James I of England, was said to really dislike hawking, falconry manuals defend it by expressing great respect for the control exercised over falcons and hawks. The verses in commendation featured in Laffam's manual is a prime example of such praise. To make the haggard tame unto your fist, to come, to go, to do even what you list, and when beyond a mountain height she's flown, to cast an ensign up shall fetch her down, to circle in her flight unto your call, and force her to your voice, and lure in fall, is strangely artful, and if pleasures be, in these inferior things it's here to see. In these verses, Laffam emphasises the artful manipulation involved in falconry, and suggests that the falconer dictates the raptor's movements even when they've been released from their restraints. But many contemporary accounts of falconry suggest that this is inaccurate. There was many accounts of falcons being lost and some legal disputes as well about ownership, where people had found hawks or falcons and the other person had claimed, "I found it, it's now mine." So Turbeville arguably condemns this aspect of falconry through his observation that despite having the whole scope of the heavens and the circuit of the earth at their pleasure to range and peruse, tamed raptors will yield themselves in such frank manner to the prison and custody of man. Turbeville portrays these creatures as prisoners of their human masters, which suggests regret at the restraint of the bird's freedom and questions their assumed autonomy. Relatedly, Berry argues that the bond between falconer and successfully trained falcon blurs the boundaries between free will and subjection, pleasure and obedience. The bird's apparent delight in service creates the illusion of complete independence. In line with Berry's argument, the dominant anxiety in early modern falconry practice was arguably that the emotional attachments a falconer had painstakingly developed with their raptor during the manning process would be overridden by the bird's desire for and also their ability to achieve their own freedom. Thank you.